The next topic discussed was predictors of response to EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors, and Dr. Vince Miller began by commenting on a non-smoker subset analysis on a Canadian trial evaluating erlotinib versus placebo.
We know from BR21, I mean, that's the biggest survival curve difference in response rate curve. The difference with the response rate is 25% in never smokers, and the median survival was a year. And the control group that got placebo did a little bit better than the rest of the control group. The median survival was 5.5 months. So never smokers probably do better overall, whether it's their comorbidities or that they're enriched for mutation, maybe both.
That was second line.
Any sense from your study yet?
Response rate in erlotinib in patients who were never smokers who had adeno or adeno with BAC is 45%. And if you had a mutation, it's 75% based on those prospective trials.
So, Vince, in the Spanish study, I think it was with gefitinib, if they had a mutation, the response rate they reported was, I think, around 80%.
That's up there. That's the PAS-ERA study.
So it's there's a range here.
Well, see, that study, they only tested for the two common mutations, 19 and 21, which we know are associated with sensitivity. So it depends on what you look for. Because there's 100 mutations that have no clear-cut biological significance at this point, and some of them even are related to resistance.
Joan, you also brought up the issue, I don't know if you want to comment a little bit, about the upcoming NCI intergroup study that randomizes FISH-negative patients to Tarceva versus Alimta. Any comment on that?
It's a second-line study that's going to be a very large study. It's a biomarker study. But patients who are FISH negative will get randomized to Tarceva versus Alimta. And I was just wondering if anybody besides me had some ethical problems with that and whether or not there's enough evidence in the literature to suggest that FISH negative patients are unlikely to do well on Tarceva.
Corey, can you comment on that?
From an American perspective, unless something really pans out differently, I think we're going to be stuck with FISH and IHC. That's my prediction. I don't know whether something better is going to come along. Maybe it'll be eat cadherin or whatever, because it's going to capture a lot more patients. I, and I think most of the others who responded to Joan, have relative equipoise with putting FISH negative on Tarceva, at least for now. Maybe that'll change. But I wonder if any of us would have equipoise if they were RAS positive.
That was also one of my next questions, because at the meeting we had in Hawaii, we spent 2 hours talking about RAS. And the big question was, should we be testing all of our patients for RAS? And is that an important question?
What do we know about response to chemotherapy with RAS?
Well, it doesn't seem to be as bad as I would have thought it was. I thought intuitively it was going to be very low, but they showed some response from subsets of other trials. Vince, I don't know whether it was your group or some group looked at this and came up with 20%, 22%.
Well, from Tribute, we have the response rates. I mean, it's a small number of patients, but it looks in the 20s. It doesn't look terribly different.
It's pretty comparable. Yeah. It's pretty comparable.
What about selection of patients to receive erlotinib in clinical practice, Vince? Both those that you identify as being enriched, whether it's from smoking status or mutation FISH, et cetera. What can we expect, and how do you think it should affect the algorithm of decision-making? What would you say to a patient in terms of chance or response? You have a patient who's a lifelong non-smoker. The patient has symptomatic metastatic disease. She wants to know what the likelihood is that she's going to get pain relief from anti-tumor therapy. So she's a non-smoker. It's all we know about her. And most of you think that she's very likely to get pain relief from using erlotinib in this situation. If we ask chemotherapy, not quite as likely. So I guess my question is, this is a first-line situation. Does that mean in these situations you would consider erlotinib first-line? Vince?
Obviously, I practice in a little bit different way with everyone except Tom. I tend to use erlotinib more either first-line or third-line. I don't have a huge second-line cohort. I'm pretty well driven by either knowing the mutation status or the clinical factors to incorporate it into therapy early on if someone has a favorable profile. I mean, a 75% positive predictive value for response if you have a mutation. We've never had anything like that in thoracic oncology. And for anyone who's treated a lot of those patients, they live a heck of a long time. And in my mind, it's just a matter of time till we establish a survival benefit from patients with mutations treated in that fashion rather than chemo. But we need the trials to be done, and they're ongoing.
What about quality of life, Ed? We're in a palliative situation. How would you compare quality of life in terms of side effects and toxicity to chemo alone or with Bev versus erlotinib?
I might be included in Vince's group here with Tom in that when I see a patient like this, especially with clinical factors, we don't do mutational testing on everybody who comes through the door. But when we see these clinical factors, mostly the never smokers or the adeno-BAC features, etc., I will give them the option, the standard of care option, which would be chemo-Bev, and that's now eligible. Most of these patients are eligible there. And then the second aspect would be to consider the off-standard therapy of erlotinib. And I'll tell you, I presented those two options to two different patients on the same day. One was a 60-year-old female who was a very light smoker, 5-pack years in her 20s. And then another one, 30, 35 years old and a never smoker. And both of them elected for the erlotinib first line option. I will tell you, though, that one of them is still on the drug. And then one of them progressed very quickly through the drug.
Tony, what's your take on this, particularly with your experience in other tumors? I hate to even say this, it reminds me a little bit of ER-positive breast cancer, where you have a much less toxic therapy, and if you look at it in a rich population, similar or greater response rates. Where do you put erlotinib in your algorithm of metastatic disease, particularly in the non-smoker?
Reminds me a lot of breast cancer, but all the data is not in yet. In that regard, I don't treat patients across the board with erlotinib in second line. I think they need to be selected out. It's becoming clearer and clearer, and I have enough information to select them out. The non-smoking patients, the Asian patients, the...
Second line or first line?
Well, either. The patient you presented in first line that was a non-smoker, my choice, if I didn't have an adequate clinical trial, would have been erlotinib. The non-smoking patient. I mean, we clearly can identify a group of patients now clinically that are likely to benefit. And with the mutations, the rate of benefit goes even higher. So I'm not going to treat the majority of patients who are FISH negative or have no mutations and who've been smoking heavily, and many have RAS mutations, with erlotinib. It's like treating estrogen receptor negative patients with tamoxifen. Now, the data is not that clear cut yet, but in my opinion, it will be within a few years. And we'll see. But certainly I'm impressed by what I see so far.
You wouldn't use it at all, or you wouldn't use it like first or second line?
I wouldn't use it in an indiscriminate fashion, second or third line. I would rather use other agents unless they're in an enriched population, and we defined that.
Alan, so, what do we know about response or erlotinib in non-enriched populations? Again, considering quality of life difference to the patient, can we be so sure that the patient's not going to benefit?
Well, the way I look at it again, and it makes for a much shorter conversation, unfortunately, but the study was positive overall with erlotinib in the second and third line setting. So I give it in the second and third line setting. And what I do is in the second line, if someone who's a never smoker, Asian, or that type who I think, or did very badly with chemotherapy, I use it second line. If I have a patient who did exceptionally well with chemotherapy in the front line setting, I'll consider chemotherapy in the second line setting and reserve the erlotinib for the third line. As of yet, all of the data and the numbers that's showing up in the subsets are 20 patients here, 30 patients there. I don't know what it necessarily means, but if you look at the subset from the BR21, to me, there's enough information that shows that the EGFR wild types seem to develop some benefits. PS2, PS3 didn't matter, second line, third line. That's how I go about it. I feel free using it. I mean, anybody use third line chemo?
Yes.
No data whatsoever, right?
We all do.
Right, we all use it. So I certainly would feel comfortable giving erlotinib.
Mark? I think we also have to be careful about separating patients who have higher response rates.
Right. We still don't know what survival means.
In patients who have survival. Because, you know, if you look at the BR21 data, the worst patient, the male squamous smoker, still had a survival advantage with this drug. Didn't have very many responses. Versus the never smoker, where the response rate was 25% and the benefit was huge in terms of survival. And to ask the question another way, is there a patient that you would never give erlotinib to? And I think the answer to that, at least in my mind, is no. I agree with Alan. The benefit was broad-based in BR21.
RAS mutant?
I never check.
I don't check.
I want to question Tony's analogy to ER-negative breast cancer, where I think at this point we have pretty good evidence that hormone therapy doesn't work. I don't know that I kind of see such strong evidence at all. And
right.
I mean, as you say, in terms of
there's evidence
unselected population, in those days when we weren't sure whether it worked in ER negative and breast cancer. A lot of times we used it because it was so non-toxic. And again, or at least relatively non-toxic. And I don't know that I see that same kind of palliative mode here.
Wouldn't you agree if you took a 1,000-patient study of breast cancer and you didn't know the receptor status and you gave them tamoxifen, it's likely in metastatic disease there would be a survival benefit of the whole group. Well, what we're learning is a certain, quote, enriched population is what carried the day in those trials, the ER-positive patients. We understand that clearly in breast cancer now. In my opinion, we're beginning to separate this out in lung cancer and to treat all patients with Tarceva in lung cancer the way Alan was talking about, or Mark, in my opinion, is like treating all patients with metastatic breast cancer without understanding the biology of the individual patient's tumor. So,
but are we there yet?
No, we're not totally there, no. But we're getting there.
But that's precisely right, is that it's all patients, and until we find a test that separates the curves, and that's the direction we're going, that's what you're saying,
that's
exactly what we have to do.
We need validated prospective trials to verify all of this. I mean, the work that Vince and Tom and others have done are wonderful, and they've really led the way as guideposts to trying to select what those markers should be. But I pretty much agree with Mark and Alan. Outside of a clinical trial, basically my patients will not die without at least a day's exposure to an EGFR inhibitor.
What do you see in terms of quality of life of a patient on erlotinib versus chemo?
We've got to do the studies that
compare
that. What's
your impression clinically?
It's variable. Some people have absolutely no toxicity. And you look at the BR21, allegedly only 5% truly bailed out because of toxicity. My clinical practice is a little bit higher. I'd guess 10 to 15%.
Vince?
I was going to make the point just on what Mark said, that even in that worst group, the squamous smokers, remember, we're comparing them there to supportive care, though. We're not comparing them to pemetrexed. We're not comparing them to docetaxel. So do most of my patients get Tarceva? Absolutely. Do they get it maybe fourth line in some cases? Fifth line, traded for a DNR order? Sure.
Absolutely.
Would I give it to a KRAS mutated patient? I personally probably not. I don't know what Tom does. I think that's the strongest thing. But, you know, if you don't know, you don't know.
Do you present it as an option as first line therapy to any of these patients, non-smoking, mutations, et cetera?
Yeah, all. No, I mean, our institutional standard of care is to give them chemotherapy and erlotinib or erlotinib alone, first line and a never smoker.
We have a randomized trial that's evaluating.
We have a CALGB study that's now an ECOG CALGB study that's trying to answer some of this.
Harvey?
So I'd like to go to the practitioner who's not in an academic setting. It used to be, I guess, when the mutational story came out, all of a sudden a lot of people were running to their doctors and saying, I want you to get me the data on this mutation in me because I want you to get that drug for me. Now, that's 2.5-3 years ago. What about now? Is it changed that doctors will ask the patient, do you want me to look at this? What do you want me to do? In other words, are we to the point, or do you think in the community we're at the point where doctors are actually saying to the patient, do you want me to look at the block that we got and see what we can do and concoct a thing for you? Or does the doctor in the community still say, well, we're going to treat by what ASCO said last week, that sort of stuff? I just throw that out there.
And are the people who are getting operated on curatively, as Vince suggested, having their tumors or bringing up to the patient the possibility of getting the tumor tested? I'm sure that's not happening. Mark?
Well, I think at the level of the community, what happens in the community right now, I think probably other than the mutation data, which is pretty compelling, the responsibility or the burden is on our molecular colleagues to give us a test that will help us identify patients. Right now, in my mind, far and away, it's smoking status. And that's how you determine what to do. And I think based upon not prospective level 1 phase 3 evidence, but I think erlotinib is a very important drug in never smokers.
The first question, line?
Yes. Well, I don't know. I mean,
do you do it in your practice first
well,
line?
Well, I put everyone on the CLGB trial, so the answer
okay,
to that is
not
yes.
Eligible.
But off of a trial, I think here are your choices. The problem is that many of these never smokers are perfect candidates for bevacizumab. So how do you make that decision? Or do you do both? That's an option. Do you do 4 cycles of chemo and then do erlotinib? Do you do erlotinib with chemo? Do you do erlotinib alone? And then how do you integrate bevacizumab in that whole thing? I don't know the right answer to that. What I tend to do, everyone goes on the CLGB trial, so it's easy for me. If they don't want to go on the CLGB trial, then what I tend to do in the never smokers is to give them chemo for 4 cycles with Avastin if they're eligible, and then give them immediate Tarceva.
With the Bev?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just kind of curious, I asked this last year, what fraction of newly diagnosed patients with lung cancer are never smokers, and what fraction are oligosmokers, you know, again, less than 15 pack total years? The answers we got last year were roughly 10% of each. Does that sound right? Anybody feel it's much higher or lower than that?
I wouldn't be surprised if it's up to 15.
So you're saying maybe 30% of lung cancer fits into this category?
Well, 30% of the lung cancer he may see.
Yeah, okay. That's high.
I'm not, yeah, that's very high from
my point. Leading accruer on the CALGB study,
am.
I think.
Is it in the 20 or 30% range?
I don't think it's that high.
I would think the sum of the two has got to be at least 20%. I mean, even the chemo prevention trials.
Okay.
You know, about just, 10%
again,
were never
keep
smokers.
In mind that about 20% of breast cancer is HER2 positive.
You know, it's interesting, this oligosmoker. Because, you know, suppose you have, this is Tennessee. So I've got patients 30 years old who've got 20 pack year smoking histories, right?
Yeah.
They've been smoking for 10 years, two packs a day. Or the oligo is what, 10 pack
year? 15. You bring up, that's right? A very important issue.
So a 30 year old patient who's been smoking since they've been 15 a pack a day.
How many 30 year old patients do you have with lung cancer?
You see them.
We see substantial.
Pack years is a terrible way to assess risk.
Well, what about time since quitting? Do we know anything about that, Vince?
There was data from MGH. I remember reviewing the paper. I think Lisa wrote it. That time away may also be somewhat predictive, but less powerful.
Is it a continuum or a cut point? Or
yeah, I think it's a continuum.
Smoking histories were terrible, are terribly tough.
Just ask one question to the cooperative group, especially since we have Joan here. In your trials now, are we prospectively getting at least the basic smoking info?
Yes. No,
so that's
are.
One thing that's come out of this, that at least we know that in all our studies now.
The excitement to evaluate erlotinib in enriched populations in the adjuvant setting has to be tempered with the understanding that the issue of skin rash must also be addressed. And Dr. Kim began a discussion of this issue.
There are some patients that absolutely it's very difficult to control their rash, but the examples we like to use is the arena TCAN examples, where people were dying left and right from diarrhea. And once an algorithm was put in place to manage it proactively, we don't even talk about it anymore. So I think as long as investigators, patients are working together, there are ways to control this rash, but again, the stakes are a little bit higher in an adjuvant setting than they are in a metastatic setting, for sure.
So what are the ways that you practically go about, again, particularly in the adjuvant setting where you're looking at a year to try to prevent or treat the rash, and how many people, given your approach, still end up having a lot of problems?
Yeah, so the Northwestern group with their series clinic, Mario Lacatours, they see all these patients. We actually have been very proactive about how we manage this rash that's due to EGFR drugs. We tend to give patients proactive measures, including topical creams such as either topical steroid creams or topical clindamycin. We will escalate to oral antibiotics, doxycycline is the most popular one, or Medrol dose packs very quickly to patients to prevent them to have to dose reduce or delay their erlotinib or their cetuximab. And by proactively sort of shooting ahead, we're able to avoid many of those things.
So what fraction of patients can get out to a year and have a reasonable quality of life?
I don't know if we have it for a year on enough patients, but I can tell you what we published at ASCO, it was in publication form only. My PharmD and my nurse practitioner published this. Out of 75 patients we saw in head, neck, and lung, only 4 of them had to be dose reduced or delayed.
You know, it's interesting. I interviewed Dr. Lecourteur for our renal cell program recently. It's fascinating. He has this dermatology clinic specifically focused on patients receiving cancer treatment, specifically EGFR and TK inhibitors. And, you know, you just wonder. I mean, he has a very serious approach. These people need to get this therapy. What can we do? Extremely proactive approach. How much of a difference that might make, not just in the adjuvant setting, but also metastatic disease. Tom, any thoughts?
So, I mean, I think the work Mario's doing is fabulous. And I think that his ability to proactively treat rash. I think the thing that he's convinced me of most profoundly is the role of moisturizers, the role of quick use of antibiotics, particularly doxycycline, the fact that doxycycline is an anti-inflammatory, not just an antibiotic. I always think of it as an antibiotic. He reminds us that the reason people use it is that it also has anti-inflammatory properties, which are very helpful. I also think some of the interesting work in rash is being done by Roman Perez-Soler, who's looking at these phosphatase inhibitors with the argument that by inhibiting phosphatases, you may be able to shut down EGFR blockade in skin. And so Roman is doing some very interesting work with rash. But there are patients who stop these drugs because of rash. So if one is able, and that it's not just erlotinib, it's CC225, it's some of the new VEGF tyrosine kinase inhibitors. So I think there is great importance to be able to control the side effects.
It's interesting, Joan, you know, thinking about the adjuvant setting and so-called the badge of cancer. In the past, it's been alopecia, and now we're starting to look at rash as that and sort of the psychosocial effects of patients, you know, sort of having to go out into the public with that.
I also wonder how that's going to affect accrual onto adjuvant studies, because whether or not people are going to be willing to live with a year or two of a rash, I don't know.
That's a good point.
But there's still some degree of tachyphylaxis to it. I mean, it's worse initially. It tends to get better. The proactive treatments help. We have, and you probably do the same thing, we cycle people on and off the antibiotics. Sometimes we'll do 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. May not eliminate it, but it keeps it manageable. But there are some delayed phenomena. We've seen this particularly with C225, but I've started seeing with erlotinib, with paronychiae and fissures, some really annoying problems that go beyond rash that are in the chronic setting.
Dry skin and pruritus are more long-term chronic effects that the typical acute acneiform thing flares.
It gets better.
It's more treatable, if you will. Patients struggle with, my skin is very dry, I itch
skin
all the
fissuring.
Time. In these paronychiae, I agree with, those are troublesome.